This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. This podcast is a venue for me to explore my curiosities through convos with leading thinkers and builders. My guest today is Colin Keeley. Colin is the co-founder of Verne, a holding company for SaaS businesses. He's also a teacher at NBPE, where he helps people learn how to buy their first online small business. This episode is a great primer on holdcos and buying online small businesses for those interested in the space. Please enjoy.
I did a bunch of startups in the past, software marketing agency, TV and movie recommendation company, started a company that sold stretchy jeans for guys, a sharing economy startup. All not like base hits, a lot of failures, some small successes, fell into venture capital and worked there for a time. Also was a startup studio. So you're spinning up different companies and like, that's just really hard. Even if you've done it before and have the capital and discovered you could just buy product market fit. So now we run Verne, which is basically a holding company for niche software companies. So we buy and grow small software companies.
What was the mindset and journey around switching from being a founder and a VC to now running a SaaS-focused holding company? What attracted you to the space?
Yeah, everyone does it kind of differently in the startup studio space. So I was kind of a student on how other people were doing it. And I discovered this guy, Andrew Wilkinson and Tiny, out in Victoria, Canada. And he was just buying things that were already working and putting in best practices. I was like, that sounds awesome. And then he also just wasn't running things. He'd hire the CEO to be the manager of each of the companies. He's like, I am envious of your lifestyle. That sounds amazing. And so we did our first acquisition and just have kind of been scaling things up since then.
And so it's not just you. You also have a co-founder partner. His name's Brent. What's the story behind how the two of you met and why is that the right partnership?
Yeah, Brent and I met at the venture capital fund. He basically ran the studio. He's like, as a profile, he had an agency in the past, like a development agency. He sold it to the venture capital fund, which is also a startup studio. And then he ran like, he's effectively a CTO for a number of different startups. So he's really good at product, really good at putting in place tech teams and also like pretty business savvy. So he runs the tech and product side of things. And I run, I call it the business, finance, marketing side of things for us. Like we were always noodling ideas. I don't think either of us thought we'd like start something together down the line, but we go to Chipotle all the time and like talk about different things. And I think there's alignment there and very complementary skill sets. So yeah, if you could find a great partner, I highly recommend doing it with a partner. It's a lot more fun.
Helps that the two of you have a background together as well. At this point you have five companies, but I think maybe only three of them you acquired. You might've actually incubated two of them. What are those companies and is there an underlying investment thesis here or is it really as simple as what's on your landing page? We buy wonderful SaaS businesses.
Yeah. I mean, Constellation is like the big dog in our space. They bought 600 of them. So very much, you know, following in their footsteps and doing that playbook. So we buy, we call them vertical market software companies. So horizontal would be software that works for everything. Think of Excel or Zoom or something like that. And vertical is like we bought one, for example, is Scout. So it's business management software for dog walkers and like pet sitters. So it's everything they need to run their business. So if you want to say we have a thesis, it's a lot around that of just, you know, picking a vertical market, buying something that's already working. So we don't do 0 to 1. We do like 3 to 10, call it. And so we buy something that's working, put in best practices and grow it.
What's the investment that you're most excited about at the moment and why?
Scout. Scout is, so this is the dog walking software. It has the most extreme kind of product market fit and there's just real significant tailwinds, not headwinds, where it's just a booming market. So there's so many dog walkers out there. A lot of them are just using Venmo or like cash and our solution is just so much better. It makes them make more money. It helps them like just kind of impress their end customers so they could charge more. It's just really fun kind of arming the rebels instead of, you know, being the big Goliath or something like Rover or Wag would be.
Looking at the entire landscape of SaaS businesses out there, and without giving away any alpha, because I'm sure there's some businesses that you're eyeing at the moment. So maybe in hindsight or in retrospect, or if you had unlimited funding, what would be your dream investment and why?
One of our companies is BlinkSale. It's horizontal invoicing. And it's just really hard to market something like that when you could kind of service everyone. So I was looking for clumps of users. We have a bunch of clumps of users in all the different trades. And I think there's an opportunity to do like basically business management software for all the blue collar trades. And each one of those could be like, you know, $100 million company. So what we've been looking at most recently, so I don't know, giving away alpha or what, it's more of like a soliciting businesses to reach out to me. All these like business management software for all the trades. So, you know, pest control, landscaping, different things like that.
Yeah. You get to ride the, everyone's using the phrase silver tsunami, the $1 trillion of small businesses that are changing hands, and many of them are going to be upgrading their software and their system. So that would be a nice opportunity to ride that.
Oh, way. So many are still just like, you know, taping checks to the door to like transact, or people are driving checks and, you know, they're calling and not answering to schedule. It's almost like the features are all very similar. It's invoicing, scheduling, messaging, but just for each of the different, you know, tailored markets.
You're focused explicitly on SaaS and vertical SaaS. There's a number of other sectors out there you could be investing in, e-com, FBA, et cetera. If you weren't focused on SaaS, what other markets would you be looking at and why?
This is the right question. I asked other people this and no one ever has a great answer, or else they'd probably be pursuing it. So I am focused on software and I plan to be for the next, you know, 50 years or whatever, my career. But I'm always looking. I would think of going into a space that other people aren't. So other people have discovered HVAC, dental roll-ups. Like there's a million roll-ups for every different thing. So I'd try to stay away from wherever private equity is playing and see where I could see underpriced assets. One of my favorite ones I've seen is like a guy buying up American foundries. So like, you know, pouring and pressing metal across the US and like bringing back American manufacturing. And that's a fun thesis. Like most of them are pretty poorly run, but if you roll a bunch together and kind of put in best practices and buy them for really low multiples, I think that's a really cool business.
You mentioned a few seconds ago, Tiny and Andrew Wilkinson and Constellation and Mark Leonard. They're probably two of the bigger players in the space. I actually had Jeremy Jaffon, the general partner of Tiny, on my previous episode. I'm curious what initially inspired you about what they're doing, and then what have you taken away and really implemented and made core philosophy for Vern?
A lot. I mean, we're heavily inspired by all those guys. I take a bunch of notes whenever I listen to podcasts from anyone that's doing something like kind of adjacent to me. And I started publishing those as like operating manuals or business breakdowns. But Andrew specifically, I think he's very, very good at delegating. So he has this whole principle of management by abdication. So it's something to always be thinking about. Should I be doing this, or can I delegate it to someone else? So he inspired us heavily, and he mentioned, you know, offhandedly that Mark Leonard inspired him. And I was like, I should learn who this guy is. And so they've bought, I think it was 134 companies just last year in 2022, which is absurd. They have a database of, I think, 50,000 prospects. And they just have an M&A machine. So they have all these prospects. They have like a directly responsible individual for each of them. And that has to just stay on top, talk to them every 6 months or something. And something as we think of scaling up, how do you do it? It's like, you really have to be decentralized. You need a lot of different decision makers. So it's kind of unfortunate. I wish they wouldn't do small deals because they swooped in and stole deals from us. But what they've built is super impressive and, you know, really inspiring.
This market, the space of micro acquisitions or micro PE is really heating up. I think we've seen, especially with platforms like MicroAcquire and Flippa, that have kind of democratized access to this and increased interest. How do you stay on top of deal flow? How do you keep creating? How do you keep your pipeline, you know, up to date? But more importantly, maybe, is how do you find proprietary sources?
Yeah, there's no like secrets in finding proprietary deals. Generally, it's just like, you know, B2B sales effectively. You know, get a big list, have someone build it for you, and then reach out, put them on drip campaigns. What's, I guess, a little unique to us is like this whole focus on content. In venture capital, it's very popular. In private equity, people are very like hush-hush and quiet. So we're just taking that like almost, at a much smaller scale, Andreessen Horowitz playbook of like just producing a bunch of content in the space. I have a course, I have a podcast, all this different stuff. And then I think through that, people get to know you and deals come inbound that are much warmer and maybe already like pretty well matched to you. The problem with outbound exclusively is like you're reaching out to people. They're always interested in like hearing what their business is worth, but it's pretty rare that they're actually interested in selling. So it makes sense at scale when you're, you know, Constellation and you could have an army of BD people, but it's much harder with a much smaller team to just stay on top of so many folks.
One strategy you seem to have employed is being a very active content creator, which we were talking about just before we started the episode. To what degree has that helped your deal flow? And do you see that as a flywheel around bringing in, you know, brokers, owners, et cetera, into your ecosystem? Or is it purely for fun? And if anything, that's just a side effect.
So definitely I benefit, like even if I wasn't publishing writing, just the act of like distilling your thinking down and taking notes is valuable. But you know, publishing to Twitter, podcasts or whatever, it is a serendipity vehicle. So it's kind of become the engine of everything we do at Verne. It's like an easy way. We get inbound investors, we get inbound deals, we get inbound like operators. So a lot of folks out there that want to buy a business, but don't want to like go do the searching. So I think down the line, if it all works out, we could basically be matchmaker between like capital, a deal, and like operators. Put them all together and like, here's your company, here's your equity, like go run with it. We'll support you however we can. Just say building that kind of decentralized organism would be the plan.
So we talked a little bit about finding deals or identifying prospective deals. I want to ask a couple more questions around kind of the end-to-end timeline from I'm seeing this thing I like to now we own this and we've got to transition it over. So the first question is around the due diligence period. There are a million different things you have to be looking at in due diligence. And at the end of the day, if you took a year, you still wouldn't know everything that there is to know about a business. Ultimately, you just got to take it on and figure it out. If I said instead of having weeks of due diligence, you only had 24 hours, what are the top 3 to 5 things you're looking at that are kind of the 80-20 around due diligence?
I think we could do the bulk of it in 24 hours. Lawyers okay. hate this. They hate doing things that quickly, but I think it's possible. So software companies are easier because there's not a lot of assets, right? I don't have to go confirm we have 20 trucks or something like that. So on the revenue side, so Brent does the tech side. He does the tech diligence. He gets read-only access to the code and looks through everything. But on my side, it's more cash flow. So on revenue, I basically follow the cash. So they say most of the money comes through like Stripe. And so you go check in Stripe, you look at the customers and everything. Does everything check out? Does it actually hit the bank account? So it would be pretty hard to fool me on the revenue side, at least. On the cost side, it would be easier to hide costs. So you have to look at basically the cost structure. Does it look reasonable to the company you're looking at? Does everything look right? Are they potentially hiding anything? Are they like paying for traffic, paying for ads somewhere that you don't see? Are they employing people at like some separate agency they have? And when you take on the business, it's gotten to be not as profitable as you thought it'd be. So I'd probably spend more time on the cost side of things just to like confirm it. Revenue is relatively easy to diligence.
So as you get deeper in due diligence and maybe kind of fast forwarding, like you've already put out your LOI, planning on acquiring this thing. You've invested several weeks into it. How do you avoid getting sucked into sunk costs? How do you avoid getting caught up in your emotions that you've already invested all this time in this thing and be really systematic and rational about agreeing to make an investment if some red flags come up down the road?
Yeah, we've killed deals, a couple bigger deals in diligence. You find a licensing issue and, sometimes you could think about, doing it if it was just your money. But if you're bringing investors into play, you just can't risk other people's money. So we kill things. It's just kind of part of the game. Deals die. There's legal costs and sunk costs in that, and it's a bummer. But realistically, you only need, if I close a few deals a year for like the next 50 years, it's a pretty awesome career. You just try to keep your funnel full. You don't get too like invested in one deal. It's easy to give this advice. It's always hard in practice. It's always a bummer when something dies, but try to move on to the next one.
And then the last question here around kind of this early time period of an acquisition. And I think this is really relevant because you're still in the early months with Scout. What are the first, call it 3 months post acquisition look like where you're trying to really get in the weeds on the business, understand it, transition it, and maybe looking in like 2 to 4 week chunks? Because I'm sure there's a lot happening rapidly there.
Yeah. I think 3 months just kind of happened or just kind of finished with Scout. So, first step perfectly for like 30 days is stability. So you talk with the founders. It's worth stepping back. Most of the founders have been doing this for like 5 to 7 years and kind of generally took the business as far as they can. Everyone asks like, why would you sell a good business? It's mostly because they're kind of burnt out from it. So we're open to them sticking around. Most of them don't want to, and they want to leave and go to, you know, the next thing. So we try to do quick transitions, and we have the ability to that most financial people don't. So most of the time it's like 30 days where we take it over. We immediately take over customer service and like slowly take over the tech side of things. So a lot of meetings with them, getting the handoff of all the passwords, which is could be a mess if they're not using like one password, that we make sure we get everything. And then from there, it's just like hire our own overseas team generally. So put a team in place and stability and make sure like everything transfers fine. And then it's just learn as much as possible. So we survey existing customers. We ask things like, you know, what's the most annoying thing about Scout? And that will give us like a list of 100 kind of small things that if you fix it, people are just so happy. If you fix like the little annoyances in their life, they really appreciate it. So we see what needs to be fixed, what kind of bigger features we can add and often charge more for on like a premium tier. It also helps us just like prioritize going forward the roadmap. If it's on like a crappy old WordPress site, we move it to Webflow. And it's pretty quick now because we have like a bunch of templates we use. So you just copy and port things over. So that works pretty well. Push on SEO. So fix any like technical SEO issues. We start churning out a couple articles a week in whatever the niche is. And then within 30 days, so we just are, or within 90 days, we're just doing this now with Scout. It was on Braintree, which is a disaster. Like all these payment processes that aren't Stripe are really poor to deal with. We have one on NCR that's even worse. So now it's taken us about 3 months where we're just now transitioning to Stripe. And then from there, we'll update pricing. You know, that's probably the easiest like early win is just bootstrappers are terrified of raising pricing. And so they're always underpricing. And so if you buy something, raise the prices, also deliver a lot of value. Customers are super happy to pay more as long as you're like, you know, delivering value and improving their business.
It sounds like you have this down pat. You've done this a few times now. As you, and maybe I imagine there's always kind of nuance there with each acquisition. As you scale and buy more businesses, you and Brent are going to have to be less and less involved in this process. How do you, and you earlier mentioned, you love Andrew Wilkinson's kind of philosophy around delegation. How do you plan to hire and delegate and step away and scale this thing? And when you do that, what will you be spending your time focusing on instead?
Yeah, I mean, candidly, it's something we're not great at and something we're definitely working on is like, so we set up a Notion, we have all these standard operating procedures. So if I'm doing something on repeat, like kind of this checklist of things we do, I try to document it all. So I do a lot of external writing, as you see on Twitter, but I do a lot of internal writing as well of just trying to like better put processes in place that I can step away and other people can step in and kind of learn from me and improve on my, you know, approaches. So that's kind of how we're thinking of it. We have a lot of operators waiting in the wings for like different companies. So I think we'll bring them on in a part-time basis as like a salesperson and then as a full-time of like, hey, you're like the directly responsible individual now for this company. And it's yours to grow and you have equity and incentives to do so.
In addition to running Vern, you have a course on acquiring small businesses called NDPE. Recommend everyone check it out. There's a parallel between what you're doing here with acquiring and teaching people how to acquire businesses and Sam Altman's How to Start a Startup course. He says he thinks he can teach people roughly 30% of what it takes to start a startup. What are the similar or what are the figures here for acquiring a business? Because there are so many different phases here. There's so many different skill sets. It's not like with venture capital with a startup where it's raising money and then operating. There's setting up deal flow. There's due diligence. There's all these steps. Can you share what the percentage is that you think you can teach and can't, and maybe give a few examples of one or the other?
So you can teach the theory and like hand people the templates and everything, but you can't force them to like go reach out to brokers, go talk to founders. And it's like that searching phase that tons of people take the course and a lot of people are successful, but the ones that aren't, it's like, did you ever do anything? Did you ever take the steps to like talk to people? And so you can't like force people to, you know, you can lead the horse to water, but you can't force it to drink. That's kind of the most frustrating thing with having a course is like, you can improve it all you want, but you can't like hold their hands and make them do something. But the ones that do, it's great. And, you know, it's super fun having a course and teaching people. I kind of always thought, like, when I was older, I'd retire and like go back to a college and teach. And turns out with the internet, you could do this now and even like a grander scale and teach more students.
Awesome. And I would argue it's far more practical and action oriented than what the average professor is going to be teaching.
Oh yeah.
Maybe as a part of the course or just separately, how do you recommend people get started in the space? Would you say try to join a holdco like Verne in a limited capacity, get familiar with operations, peek your head into what's going on behind the scenes with deal flow and due diligence? Should they just go buy a $10,000 SaaS business and figure it out on their own, or maybe something else?
So I'm partial to learning by doing, and I always like the start small, make small mistakes approach. So I love the idea of buying like, you know, a $10,000 SaaS. I don't know if they have revenue, but 10, 50, 50, something like that, a smaller thing, and just like trying to do it. It's kind of all the same steps as buying $100,000, $1 million business. Once you hit like 10 million, it gets a little more complicated. But it's all the same steps, and you can kind of go through the experience and not, you know, risk a big chunk of your net worth. That's my preference. You could always join. I mean, all the big kind of accumulators or, you know, Constellation, whatever, their limitation is almost always like competent operators. So you could definitely join one of them and kind of get an inside look at how other people do it. But I think most people going this route are generally pursuing some form of freedom. And if you're joining a bigger company, it's much more like having a job again.
There's a very logical and slow approach you can take to this space where you do exactly what we just talked about. You buy a $50,000 SaaS, figure out the mechanics, level up from there gradually, you know, deal by deal, year by year. And we can kind of, there's almost four levels to this game. I'm being very, you know, binary here in terms of my description, but there's that. There is what you and Brent are doing with Verne. There's maybe what Andrew and Chris Sparling are doing with Tiny. And then there's maybe what Mark Leonard is doing with Constellation. Those are kind of the levels to the game. Do you have to climb that ladder gradually? Like, why didn't you mention that you want to learn by doing, but why didn't you and Brent go out and, you know, get a $5 million SBA loan and buy a big business, or go out? I'm sure you could have raised $10 million and bought a massive business. Why are you trying to take the slow compounding approach to this?
It's the right question. It's hard to buy a software business with an SBA loan, especially $5 million. Maybe some brokers will, or, you know, lenders will say they'll do it. But when you like press them to do it, they want something. Generally, if you fail, they could go like repossess the building. And there's not that. If you run a software company in the ground, there's just nothing there, nothing remaining. So it's hard. Doing an SBA route is hard for the software. So I'd say most other folks, if they didn't come from like a bigger firm, so like Robert F. Smith runs Vista Equity. He came from a bigger, you know, private equity fund. And so right out the gate, I think he raised like $1 billion. So that's great if that's the path you have and you like, have a credibility of like doing similar deals. Andrew and Chris at Tiny, they had a profitable agency. So they started small and just continued to scale up and compound. Mark Leonard started a little bigger. He raised like a $25 million fund. So that's, I think, realistically, what we're going to do is we're going to keep doing good deals. I know some other folks that do like three independent sponsor deals. So that's where you raise on a deal by deal basis and then turn around and raise a $200 million fund. So I think in our near future is raising a bigger fund, but like a $10 million fund is pretty hard to make work and like even pay salaries and like pay the bills. So it only makes sense if you do something a little bigger, which is more of what we'd be thinking of doing in a few years.
Are you purely bootstrapped so far, or have you raised on a deal by deal basis?
So we started bootstrapped by necessity. And then recently we rolled everything into a holding company and have raised equity on that. So kind of like, you know, we started with our own money plus debt and then ended up backfilling equity, and going forward, we'll be raising money on deals.
Got it. What has been the hardest challenge so far in scaling Verne, whether that's deal flow, funding, finding quality team members, and what do you foresee being the biggest challenge in this next stage of growth?
So in this space, it kind of follows a pretty predictable path. As you're starting, it's deal flow. You have no idea where to like even find credible or good deals to do. As you get a little bigger, and probably where we are, it's more capital. You get more deals, and then it's like, well, I got to go find money, because this is a kind of a game of capital allocation and other people have more money than us, which is why Constellation beats us out on deals. And then as you get bigger, it's just like operators. So this is where Andrew Wilkinson is where Mark Leonard is. They just have so many, you know, wholly owned companies that you just need credible operators to run them all. And that's like your choke point then in the future.
We talked about earlier how acquisition entrepreneurship is getting more and more popular. But some of the infrastructure here, especially around, you know, traditional physical small businesses, and thinking platforms like BizBuySell, aren't really up to par with the kind of with the quality of people that are looking to enter the space. And so the result is there's a lot of noise. There's not great tooling to support this end-to-end journey. What is the missing infrastructure here around, whether it's the acquisition side or the operating side? And then if you were to have to go out and build something in the space, where do you think the biggest opportunity is?
So the biggest opportunity is always, I think, being the acquirer. That's where you like you own equity. Like that's the big space to be in. So that's obviously what we chose. The problem with this, like buying companies generally, is it's kind of the Wild West. Like every deal is far too unique, far too much of like a snowflake, where you're negotiating each legal doc, the LOI, the asset purchase agreement. All that should just be standardized. And there's no reason we have to like have so much back and forth. So folks are working on it. MicroAcquire, or now Acquire, is getting better. So they're trying to take in more of like the process and just kind of standardize things, because there's a lot of wasted money, a lot of wasted transaction fees that probably spook the buyers and the sellers much more than there needs to be. Like if you're buying a house, which is kind of the scale of a lot of these smaller transactions, it's like a much more professional process and there's steps at play. I don't think we need regulation here, but it would be nice if someone with credibility came out and said, like, these are our standard docs, and that standard docs for the industry. YC and other folks have kind of done this for venture capital. Private equity is just, you know, behind and isn't quite there yet.
Yeah. One thing that struck me that as I've dabbled with looking at small businesses was something as simple as the NDA process for getting the prospectus and being able to look into a business. The fact that I can't sign, I think Flippa now has this actually, but BizBuySell certainly doesn't. Being able to just sign one NDA that's a blanket NDA, I can now look at any deal quickly. And on top of that, there's folks still using paper and pencil. I got to print it out. I got to fax it back to them. So very antiquated. I think there's a lot of opportunity to improve on the market side of this, in addition to what you're doing with the actual acquisitions. Zooming out for a second, if you were to look back 10 years from now, assuming you're still operating Verne, I think that the long-term plan, and you've succeeded, and I'll leave that definition up to you. You can get into that if you want. What do you think the biggest reason will be?
Just showing up every day. I think we know what we have to do, and it's not like super glamorous work. And maybe you talk about it on podcasts or whatever, but it's really just like showing up every day, you know, putting up numbers, growing the companies you buy, buying good companies at good values. And I guess it's really just executing. It's like nothing special or nothing too shocking. I think we picked the right game, and now we just have to, you know, continue playing the game and do it well.
What is your definition of success for Verne?
Is there a
figure that you have in mind? Is it a number of acquisitions? Is it your role?
What's tough is I don't control everything, right? So like it's inbound deals, things pop up. I don't want to like, we have no pressure to deploy a certain amount of capital in a certain period of time. So it's less quantifiable. It's more like, are we doing it every day? Are we growing the things we own? Are we seeing good deals? And are we, you know, probably doing a few a year? So if I did, you know, one in the next year, I'd probably be a little bummed. If I did 12, I'd be pretty shocked. So, you know, three or something would be a great goal, but I don't want to force myself to, you know, squeeze three in just to do it. So just keep scaling up what we're doing, keep doing it at a higher level.
In addition to thinking on a longer time horizon from a business perspective, you're also now doing that as if you weren't already, but you're also doing that more so as a new father. You had your first son about 3 months ago, and you had a bit of a scary experience there where he spent 5 days in the NICU. Can you explain how having a kid, and especially having that experience early on, has kind of changed your perspective on life and your relationship to work. Whereas previously, I'm sure your wife was a big focus as well, but mostly it was about the work. But now you have this third person to take care of and thinking about their future as well.
Yeah. Well, 3 months in, obviously I'm an expert, so happy to give you all my wisdom on this.
Well, that was going to be my next question.
Yeah. Overall, I'd say it's awesome experience. I was never really that into my friends' kids or like in any sense, but it's super fun having your own. So highly recommend to everyone. I've been loving it. It's cool to see this kind of learning machine. They're actually just horrible at everything. Like they can't even control their eyes in the early days. And now he's just like starting to track across the room and smile on purpose. So super fun. As far as like work-wise, obviously it takes a lot of your time away. Like in the morning, I normally like to write. Instead, I'm like, feeding the kid and doing all these things, but it's a trade-off and worthwhile. So I'd say flexibility and like time management have probably become significantly more important. And then just like in the house, I'm fairly minimalist. I don't have a lot of stuff. We've had just an explosion of things. It's crazy how much like a 12-pound person requires. So I was always like anti-big car, never understood why anyone has a big car. Now I think I need like the biggest car they sell because it's so crazy to travel with this little like 12-pound thing. You need a whole car full of stuff to go anywhere.
So you joked at being an expert, but I do want to get your take on some of the early lessons you've learned being a parent. What has it taught you? What are some of the kind of foundational things that you've come to realize?
I'd say it's not as hard as people make it seem. I think everyone's like, oh, your life will never be the same again. You're never going to sleep again. Obviously, your sleep sacrificed a little bit, but it's all worth it. It's not that big of a deal. Anytime everyone's like, things are really hard, I'd never find it to be that hard. It takes work, but it's all worth the trade-off, at least, so far. And I think it'll continue to improve down the line.
That's my experience as well. It's more about awareness and patience and the effort than it, like you just have to be there, especially at the stage you're at, where they can't do much. It's just physical needs. But even as now I have a 1.5-year-old, it's just making sure she doesn't get into trouble. She doesn't burn her hand. But I wouldn't say particularly it's difficult. Now, I bet people who have 10, 15, 20-year-olds might say something different as it shifts from physical to more like psychological and emotional needs. So maybe I'll check back in when I get there. So I always like to conclude with the same question. Sometimes this opens up new questions. But that question is actually to flip it back on you. What's one question that you'd leave me and listeners with, whether to ruminate on or act on? It can be anything.
I think people should always be thinking about, are you playing the right game? So it took me a while. I kind of jumped around different career paths and it took me a while to end up in software private equity. But like, what do you really want to do in life and kind of work your way back from that? And if you're not on that path, I would try to get on that path as soon as possible and leave whatever path you're currently on. Are you playing the right game is something you should be thinking about.
That has come up. And I say this in a good way. That's come up more often than not when I've asked this question. And I think the people that I admire and I found to be successful or pursuing their definition of success have spent a lot of time exploring that question, whereas others haven't. So it's a good reminder to me. I was actually writing about this morning and I'll get back to it later this evening and the rest of this week. But there is really no point in trying to go and do something to take time and energy if you don't know if that is the thing for you and why you're doing it. I'm curious to kind of double click on that or dig in a level deeper. Was there a moment for you where you felt like, oh, I know this is the game I want to be playing. This resonates with me. And what was the work or the thinking or the writing you did to get there?
I think a lot of people, a lot of my friends, you choose the path of least resistance. It's easy. Continue doing what you're doing. I was working in venture capital and I was looking as like a junior person, looking at my path forward. And my path forward is basically, oh God, I hope I invest in like a Cameo or an Uber or something like that. And then I could raise my own fund and then I could go from there. But there's a lot of luck involved. And it's like, hey, hopefully that comes across your desk. Hopefully they randomly follow you on Twitter or something. And I didn't want to be not in charge of my destiny. in like software private equity, after you buy something, you control the company. And it's like, it's on you to do things. And you don't have to be a genius to like put in best practices and grow. So maybe there's like a boringness premium there, but or boringness discount. But I like the path where I fully controlled my destiny. And there's a lot, like the average person in the space does incredibly well. And so I didn't want to also take like the venture backed startup path of like, oh, maybe I will be a billionaire and have a private jet. Or, but, you know, 85% or 90 plus percent likelihood, like my business is going to flame out and I'm going to have spent doing 5 years doing this thing and I'll have to do something else afterwards.
That makes sense. Awesome. Well, Colin, thank you so much for coming on. It was great to have you and looking forward to seeing where Burn goes from here.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me. Take care.